Well, I was overcome by that hymn. I had forgotten that that was going to be the hymn before the preaching. That hymn was sung the first Sunday I ever preached here in April of 1988. It is my life faith in four verses. If someone later on in years to come says, "What was he like? What did he believe? Read, O love that wilt not let me go." George Matheson was a minister of the Church of Scotland in the middle of the 19th century in a small parish. He was going blind, and there was nothing that could be done for it. He was desolate about it. One day, when his family was off to some function in the town, he was sitting by himself in the manse, and he picked up the pen, and the hymn wrote itself, four verses, "O love that wilt not let me go." If you want to know what the old boy was about at some level, and you may not, just read, "O love that wilt not let me go." Well, that was a lovely moment. I can sit down now. John Wesley said, "Unless God raises you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you? Are all of them together stronger than God? Oh, do not be weary of well-doing. Light yourself on fire with passion, and people will come from miles to watch you burn." That's our founder, John Wesley. No wonder people of faith get tired in their arms. Have you noticed your arms are tired a lot of the time? Because as we ride along in the great coach of the church, the chariot of the church, we are holding the reins of two horses that do not match. They run side by side, but there's always tension between the two horses. I've always sensed it. But it struck me in the last few days, looking at these texts, something of what the tension is about. One horse is a mighty Percheron, one of those large farm horses with the big hairy feet, tall and thunderous, with a black coat glistening, and a long mane, and a tail flying in the breeze. Gentle by nature most of the time, but will turn and bite and kick if threatened. This horse represents the sacred texts and the stories of biblical Israel. We are the children of biblical Israel, and we've ridden on the back of that large black horse since childhood, in the company of such friends as Adam and Eve, and Abraham and Sarah, and Samson and Delilah. By the way, the words Samson and Delilah mean light and darkness. Isn't that interesting? The battle of Samson and Delilah, the battle between light and darkness. That's just an aside. Don't put that in my rendition of faith at the end of things. And then there's Moses and David and Solomon and Ruth and Naomi and the rest. We've ridden with them all together since childhood, smiled at them, come to know them on the back of that black horse. And the essence of that black horse is a sense of rescue from slavery. Whatever else it is, it was once held against its will in a great pen and was rescued. Now we as communities of faith, as did the ancient Israelites, always feel slightly small and different from other people and slightly hunted. And yet we feel we're being led towards a great thing, although we can't fully see it. And we are here to be our very best selves in the world and to represent well that which has called us into being. We're to be alive every day in our life and to be watchful for our enemies, because we never know when the enemies will come. To be on the back of the black horse is to be like part of a caring family. Our parents lead and protect and discipline us, and our siblings, well, we squabble with each other sometimes around the dinner table, but out on the street we have each other's backs. No one picks on my brother, no one picks on my sister. So this is the strong, everyday in the world horse. The other horse is a sleek and slender palomino, golden and bright-eyed with long flowing auburn tail. Always ready to run, and always needing to be held back slightly. Always ready to jump a fence too high and to leap across a river too wide. This horse represents a tributary, one small but important stream in the river of ancient Israel's life. And it's called the dream of the Messiah. It's just one part of Israel's life, but the dream of the Messiah is the part that we have hooked onto on this side of the wagon. The right person comes along at the right time, and the great God blesses the tribe through that person, and all the world changes. Old Testament heroes were thought to be messianic, arriving on the scene at the right time with messages and strength from God. The New Testament evangelists, if you think about it that way, the early martyrs of the church might be called messianic as well, because by their words and their actions, we and the world have been blessed. Well, over time, the messianic idea became formalized in Jewish culture. The king was the Messiah, and the high priest was the Messiah, and prophetic voices, if they fit the model of the culture, were messianic, and the ruling generals and the noble warriors, if they had fought well, could be said to be instruments of God. And then later on in time, the messianic idea went even deeper into the world of cosmic mythology. It is said that when a nation or a tribe is under stress, it moves in two directions. It either goes backwards, thinking about a golden age, or it goes forward, hoping for a consummation that will bring it out of its current trouble. The golden age was thought to be the age of King David's reign, and the future was to be an apocalyptic moment when the great God would break into history and right the tribe and strengthen its truths. Meanwhile, they were stuck in the middle under the oppression of the Roman Empire. So this yearning for the end of things, the messianic visit, was extremely strong at the time of Jesus' life. This horse, this palomino, speaks of eternal things, about our cosmic destiny, about the salvation of our souls, about our unity with God. Indeed, if you think about it, all the attributes of all the other gods, the Greek and the Roman gods, the gods to whom we could plead, the ones to whom we could take the case of our lives, the ones from whom we needed things, are all summed up in this cosmic vision of the messianic hope. The horse bolts widely towards the field of dreams. This horse needs to be carefully held. Well, all cultures tell a similar story of a local hero who braved the wider world and won. It's called the monomyth, and every human heart tells the same story across the world over time. He fought the good fight, he won the day for us. And so the story of the suffering and the death and the resurrection of the Messiah is the Jewish Christian version of the great story dressed in the clothing of the recognizable tribe. It involves the political fight against Rome and the cultural battle for Jewish survival and the long-term union with the holy, which we all seek. So this horse, this palomino, is the horse of the inner journey. So there are the two horses. One, we're riding through life, trying to do the right, just, and loyal thing every day on the black horse, and we're also thinking eternal cosmic thoughts and our belonging to the wide world. With the palomino, we have a rein in both hands. Well, the story of the stinging serpent and the bronze serpent of healing arrives on the back of the black horse, the Percheron. The serpent, you see, in the ancient world was a mixed symbol. It was a sign of terror and death, to be sure. People feared snakes. But it was also considered a sign of royalty and fertility and healing. You'll remember that pharaohs in Egypt had a cobra on the top of their crowns. So here in this story, the children of Israel are walking through the daily world towards a sensed but unknown destiny, just as we are walking through a similar world, and always at the edge of danger and always fighting for survival. Now in this story, just before the part that was read to us this morning, the Israelites have just battled the Canaanites. That's a very foolish thing to do. The Canaanites were the great empire of the area. They had been settled there for thousands of years, merchants and military might. It's like the attack on the World Trade Center foolish, foolish terrorist attack on the great monolith of the world. You know right away that every Canaanite in the place will be turning his attention and his weaponry towards the fleeing tribes of Israel. They had one clash, and they won it, and then they fled. And the story says they took a wide detour around the Reed Sea, choosing to go through marshy ground in order to avoid contact with the Edomites. Well, who were the Edomites? The Edomites in the ancient world were a very fierce group of nomadic people, cousins probably to the Semitic tribes of Israel. They lived in a mountainous terrain through which there was one green valley. If you wanted to pass from one side of the Edomite territory to the other, you had to go through the narrow valley. And wouldn't you know it, there were hill forts built all the way along that valley and watchers with weapons. It was so easy, you see, to fall for the power and glamour of Canaan on the first case. It still is easy. There is the big money and the flashy lifestyle and 1,000 thrills and temptations. One roll of the dice in Canaan and it could change everything for you. Canaan, you see, can break your moral standards and your self-respect and your sense of place in the tribe. Well, that marks the rise of the stinging serpent. The writer of the story says the God who has called us to loyalty is not going to stand idly by and watch us drift off into Canaan. It isn't going to happen. There's no place for disaffection in following the will and work of God. And the threat of Edom is different. The threat of Edom is that we will turn tail and run from things when courage is called for. I don't see it. I don't meet it. It isn't about me. I don't have to do anything about social responsibility. I don't care what happens in the culture. Let the wars rave on. As long as I'm making my money and I have my pension and I can go away for summer vacation. So we put our heads down and we run through the long valley hoping to get to the exit safe and sound. Life's problems and social inequities are other people's concern. We run through it untouched. That's the risk of Edom. But you see, we're all in this world together, in this generation together, and the ruin of one life allows the ruination of all lives to enter into the room and be part of the agenda. But there's mercy here too, you see, in this story, because the leader of the tribe discerns a means of rescue. He creates a bronze serpent, and he erects it in the middle of the group. The message is, if you can see the face of evil, if you can recognize what it looks like in yourself and around you, you can begin to be healed from it. Name the evil, pursue its practitioners, refute its claims, and you can be healed. Hence the bronze serpent. Well, the other horse, the golden palomino, bearing the messianic deliverer, is found in John's story about if I be lifted up, will draw all people to myself. This is the story of Nicodemus in John chapter 3. Nicodemus, his name means a leader of the people, so in John's writing, this figure is a symbolic representative of Judaism at its best. He is a symbol of the best of his tribe and his culture. And in the encounter between Jesus and Nicodemus, between Jesus and the best of Judaism, the encounter takes place at night, by the way, in secret. Jesus begins to teach Nicodemus about this messianic moment, this thing which is a tributary in Judaism, but which has such power in it. And Nicodemus recognizes the messianic power around him, standing before him in the person of Jesus, but he can't quite figure out how it works. And the Messiah begins to speak to him about a new freedom and a new vision of things and a power beyond simple tribal belonging and the systems that sustain it. And he leads Nicodemus along as someone would lead a young colt. To see the messianic moment, he says, is a gift. It is not a threat. It is divine revelation, and it's a gift. We are not simply a small and wary little tribe being hunted and trying to hold our place in a big world. We are beloved children of an eternal power with a wind within us, free to blow wherever it will and do remarkable things. You see, we see the range and the miraculous outcome in the Messiah on the cross. The text about the wind blows where it will was read at Iona at a morning service one day, and I was sitting beside a rather stiff Englishman, and I turned to him after the reading and I whispered, "Do you hear how free we have become? Do you hear the freedom God gives us in that text?" He said, "I don't think that's what it means." Well, that is what it means. That's exactly what it means. The messianic moment sets us free. John writes, "God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God sent his Son into the world, not to condemn the world, but that through him the world might be saved." Here is the great cosmic hero of all the tales coming back from the wars, bringing the boon to us. The heroic life remembered is the gift. It plants seeds of truth among us. It gives us a presence, a reality to trust. The Messiah on the cross is the bronze serpent seen in the Old Testament. Look on him, see what is unfolding in this moment, and begin to be healed in a deep place in your life. "Once I was blind, but now I see." Now, we're mostly Methodists at our root, and having Dr. Phyllis Earhart from Emmanuel College come and speak to us a week or so ago about our Methodist roots confirmed that for me. Methodism was a small sect. It was born in the 18th century in the midst of cultural and social revolution. Its founders, John and Charles Wesley, were Anglican clergy. The churches were empty, and John Wesley decided to go outside and preach in the graveyard. That's the only way people would come near. He was ordered by the church to go back into the buildings, and he refused. And from then on, he preached wherever the people were. In bars and taverns, in open fields, he traveled 75,000 miles a year on the back of a horse until he was in his 90s. And he began to grow small Methodist groups, communities of teachers and learners who cared about each other and lived a strict, moral, spiritual life in the community, a small sect. And they were ridiculed. Oh, dear, they were persecuted. They were so tight with their moral values, so restricted in their social practices. Even in this city in the early days, no dancing, no drinking, no fun, no theater, loyalty to home and family, never stepping over the line and all the rest. Tut, 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 they said, such tight, tight little people. But you see, the Methodists were seeking to honor and follow the example of Jesus Christ. And they were also saying, if these are the things that are ruining the society in which we live and breaking the lives of the people around us, we shall model in ourselves the way to resist them in order to make changes at the broader level that will help everyone, a very high motive. These choices came from the Percheron, the beautiful black horse, the hunted tribe awake to a great mission, and willing to pay a price to work with clean hands and sleep in the peace of a clean life, to set by their very presence an irrefutable standard of faithfulness for others to see and follow. But we also hold the reins of the Palomino. Our hearts are awakened to God. We do sense ourselves to be eternal children of the divine. This is a big dream. This is a multi-generational planting, and we are doing our best in our little lives for the whole of creation. We dare to say that our little lives and our decisions made today, although we do not know how they connect, have profound influence for the whole of the story, and our names will be seen among all the other saints and heroes when the thing is summed up at the end. God is winning the day, we say, in Christ Jesus, and we are part of it. Now, these two horses whose reins we hold can never be reconciled. Our arms are going to be tired as long as we are people of faith. The tension to hold them, however, increases our faith, and the watchfulness necessary awakens us to what's going on in the community and what strength we have in ourselves. We are a community of mutual support with God-given strength as to how a healthy world may live. We fight the false gods of the Canaanites, and we brave the destructive raids of the Edomites. We're also leaders for a people destined to be awakened to power and spiritual transformation. Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in God. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all people to myself, said Jesus. Now both horses pulling together, both the black horse of the traveling tribe, which we are, and the golden mare of eternal life, in which we believe, can mirror and proclaim the prophetic truth. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives and release to prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, to comfort all who mourn, to give them a garland instead of ashes, a mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with eagle's wings. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint.